Egypt on Sunday. He also warned of the impact of Israel's month-long war on Gaza that was having around the world. And this is exactly what we will be talking about in the next half an hour. I am your host, Gisum Shah Ahmadi, and you're watching The Spotlight. And to delve into the issues I just mentioned, we have with us Ali Salam, editor-in-chief of Basira Press, who is joining us from Tehran, and also Ramiro Funes. There he is, Ramiro Funes, activist and commentator who is joining us from Los Angeles. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen for joining us on this edition of The Spotlight. Now, the daily assault on the human dignity of Palestinians is creating a crisis that is undermining the credibility of the international community in general. The entire world seems to be silent. Mr. Salam from Tehran, what do you have to comment on this one?
The latest massacres are absolutely barbaric. It's incredible to just see what's coming out. It's not just, for example, in the ones that we've seen in the past where they kill a bunch of people flat out. This time they're resorting to very sadistic acts of torture and revenge, specifically in the siege of Al-Shifa Hospital. We've all seen the reports about how they've been raping women, raping pregnant women, beating pregnant women, and then killing some of their victims and forcing the men to watch it. That's, it's one thing when they kill people, which is obviously brutal, but to leave people alive and then to subject them to this kind of physical and psychological torture is absolutely unimaginable. It breaks the human heart into a million pieces. And the fact that they were able to get away with a lie saying that Hamas was the one who did this despite no proof. And in fact, many of the Israeli outlets backing away from their original claims, because not because they care about telling the truth, but because they realized their lies were too absurd to stand the light of day. But this is their sadistic and very satanic sense of revenge. And these types of massacres, as well as the terrorist attack in Moscow, occurred around the time of the holiday of Purim, which is actually a quite racist and genocidal holiday, which basically celebrates the genocide of Persians in the Book of Esther in the Old Testament, where the king of Persia was married to a Jewish queen, and she suspected that one of the people were trying to kill all the Jews, essentially, but turned out that's not the case. But she still ordered basically a mass murder spree of innocent people suspected of being, you know, the enemy of the people of Esther. And so every year this holiday is celebrated, and it's not just extending to Persians, but anybody who they view as their enemy. This is like celebration of revenge. It's very, you know, very, very sick stuff. And it's the invasion of Iraq in 2003 happened around this time. So these types of vengeful acts, these bloody acts, happen around this type of this time of the year. So this is a very sick and twisted army, and their terroristic acts should be condemned by the whole world. And the fact that the international organizations are just sitting there shows how useless they are. No matter what kind of statements they make, a statement is not going to make a difference. The only thing that is really hopeful for the Palestinians to end this absolute nightmare, as I've described, is the armed resistance and their allies in the world.
Well, you're absolutely right, and the whole world recognizes that it is past time to be silent, and there needs to be some effective measure taking place. So let's bring in our guest from Los Angeles to explain and elaborate more on that. As our guest from Tehran just mentioned, we need more than just rhetoric at this point in time. We need some action on the ground. So what do you expect from these international organizations, basically the international community, to do?
Like Brother Ali said, the international organizations are completely useless. The United Nations and a lot of the Western-led multinational institutions are not doing anything to rectify the situation, because they're never going to fundamentally get to the core problem, which is the existence of the settler colonial state of Israel in general. A lot of the dialogue has been presented as two-state solution, or how do we calm down the Israelis? How do we get them to pacify a little bit, to relent from Gaza, relent from the West Bank expansions? But the problem is Israel in and of itself. The very nature of its existence, the very foundation of its creation, going back to Theodor Herzl and the World Zionist Organization, just as Ali pointed out very brilliantly as well, the Zionists are very much portrayed as, in Western media at least, they're portrayed as secular, democratic. They're not these crazy religious fanatics as, unfortunately, Muslims are portrayed in Western media. But if we look at the people who are running Israel, they are very much religious fanatics. And a lot of these attacks coincide with Purim, with the Book of Esther, with Ishtar, which is the actual meaning of Esther, Ishtar, which is one of the Canaanite gods that they worship, a fertility goddess, if we go into the avenue. But a lot of this stuff goes deep into their mysticism and their religious extremism. They view Palestinians as animals. They don't see them as human beings. They don't see them as equals who they can coexist with. They see them as obstacles to their complete expansion. At the end of the day, we know that the two blue stripes on the Israeli flags represent the Nile and the Euphrates. They want to expand as much as they can. And for them, they see the Palestinians, the Arab peoples, the Muslim people in general, as the biggest obstacle. Because at the end of the day, the biggest resistance to Israeli Zionism is Islam and the axis of resistance, because the axis of resistance is firm in its faith and it rejects the lifestyles and appurtenances of Zionism, of commercial banking, of usury, of loaning money on interest and all of these horrible things. And it is the Muslims and the axis of resistance that are giving the best fight to Israel, because they are guided by an ideology that promotes humility and subservience to God and fear of God alone. And I think what we're seeing, I'm very optimistic about the prospects of change against Israel. It's not going to come from the UN. It's not going to come from the US or Europe. It's going to come from the Ummah. It's going to come from the axis of resistance in actually defeating Israel, not just fighting for a two-state solution, not just ending this current struggle that's going on, but completely and totally freeing Palestine and leaving Israel in the dustbin of history where it belongs.
Well, that is going to take, just as you mentioned, a very long time. So considering the situation on the ground, what do you think would be the best solution for at least a short-term humanitarian ceasefire to get aid inside the Gaza Strip? Let's see what Mr. Ali Salam from Tehran believes we should be doing.
Well, as our brother Ramiro pointed out, that they want to expand to the Nile and Euphrates, but you see they're so fragile even within the borders that they have. They can't capture the West Bank, so I'm optimistic as well. And they have been militarily humiliated in the past, two times in Lebanon. And even now, we can consider this a big humiliation, because never before has Hamas or the Islamic Resistance in Palestine been able to do these kinds of feats. If they expected anything around the time of last year, they didn't expect something of this magnitude. They wouldn't have expected anything that would have humiliated them, because the battles in the past have just been exchanges of rocket fire and rocket fire on the side of the Palestinians and airstrikes on the side of the Zionist occupation. Perhaps they thought it was going to be something like that. Again, few days cleans up. Now, this is something that has caught them by surprise, nor did they expect Lebanon to get in. I mean, the north is practically empty. There's no people in northern occupied Palestine. And if you look at the statistics of how many so-called Israelis have left Palestine and gone back to where they came from originally, like Europe or America or wherever, and people who say that they won't come back, more and more people are packing the airports and getting out of there. So this will actually eventually break the regime. The global shipping blockade imposed by Yemen, which is making the entire world pay the price for these horrible atrocities. There's at least some sense of justice here, and the optimism that our guest in Los Angeles spoke about. This optimism is that they're paying a price for what they're doing. They're not just standing there killing all these people, raping all these women, and getting away with it. That's the thing that we should be proud about. This is the achievement of armed resistance. If it wasn't for this resistance, they would do what they want to do, and they would get away with it. That would be the biggest crime, is that they would get away with it. But now they're paying the price. Eventually, it will break them, and eventually they'll have to declare military defeat, probably their biggest military defeat since 2006 with Lebanon.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
The Israelis are now in a situation where they really have no way to go, and eventually they will be defeated, both on international scale, as far as international community is concerned. And now their true colors have been known to the entire world. So they have been practically defeated on all different fronts. But what I'm more concerned about in our discussion right now is the situation on the ground in Gaza, the situation that our Muslim brothers and sisters have as they desperately need aid to get in. And the trucks are there, the aid is there, but the Israelis won't let the aid in. And I would like to quote Antonio Guterres, who just said that they desperately need what's been promised, but they need a flood of aid, not trickles and not drops. So, Mr. Funes, in your opinion, what can be done to get that humanitarian aid inside? And that would definitely require at least a temporary ceasefire.
I think crucial to this is understanding the geopolitics of Gaza. Gaza has a large coastal front, and access to that coast is very crucial. So if we were to bring aid to Gaza, first and foremost, pressuring Israel to allow other countries, other forces, no matter what political tendency or ideology, to just bring in aid from the coast, because logistically that is the best option. Another option is obviously the elephant in the room, Egypt, which shares a large border and the Rafah crossing with Gaza. But unfortunately, Egypt in many ways has been difficult and has not been cooperating with the movements toward opening the border and allowing Palestinians in and bringing in aid. And it's very much unfortunately compromised by the Zionists. So I think logistically in real time now on the ground, the best situation would be some sort of massive aid delivery through the Mediterranean onto the Gaza coast, because that is its biggest coastline. Perhaps the U.S. mentioned building a pier. Obviously, we don't trust the U.S. in any of their plan, but I don't think the pier in and of itself is a bad idea. I would just like to see other nations or countries be able to be part of that, perhaps China or Russia or Iran, to be able to airlift products and goods and aid through the Mediterranean. But I think definitely Egypt would be a tremendous help, being able to bring aid through the Rafah crossing. But again, unfortunately, Egypt is very much compromised. So I think those are our two best options now. And I think anything that Iran would try to do would be perceived as a threat to Israel. And we know at the end of the day that Israel wants war against Iran. And so it's very much Iranian people want to do more and are doing a lot as it is now. But unfortunately, it's one of those situations where we also have to tread lightly and delicately in the region, because any sight of an Iranian, you know, Red Crescent ship or aid from Iran is going to be perceived as they're supporting terrorism and this and that. So I think those are realistically the two probably best options right now, but again, very difficult.
So, Mr. Salam, in your opinion, why do you think attempts for a humanitarian ceasefire, and I'm emphasizing on this ceasefire to be humanitarian in order to get humanitarian aid into Gaza, despite the Geneva Conventions and everything that the Western world is so proud of calling itself the civilized world, why is it so difficult for them to get humanitarian aid inside, and why is this ceasefire so impossible?
This has really exposed their hypocrisy. As you stated, they're very proud of these types of things, their Declaration of Human Rights, Geneva Convention. But we see how it falls apart. We see what it truly means when the rubber meets the road. So, like our guest said, the Egyptians have the capacity. I mean, don't they control their own country? Aren't they a sovereign government? Apparently not. They have ties to, they normalize, they were one of the first governments to normalize with the Israelis. and they have huge ties to the U.S. In fact, their current leader was installed by the U.S. So we can really, you know, to create a scenario for at least a humanitarian ceasefire, as much as the Israelis will violate those terms, but they're going to be forced to the table. The Israelis will be forced to the table of doing this for the sake of their military defeat. That's what will pressure them. Just as the first ceasefire happened because they were really getting hit very hard, and they were essentially humiliated. So they have to get hit more and more hard. But I think they don't want to get embarrassed a second time around. They don't want to get like the full embarrassed. Like when the full war ends, they'll be totally embarrassed because they can't guarantee the safety of their illegitimate settlers. But on the diplomatic side, at least when it comes to the untrustworthy Qataris and the untrustworthy Egyptians, we can hope for the equation of the declining and weakening U.S. and the increasing strength of Iran and, to a lesser extent, Russia and China, because Iran is the most bold in support of Palestine compared to the latter two, who do not exert to the full capacity that they could exert, but still better than what the position of the West is. And in fact, we see this in the agreement that Ansarullah of Yemen has had with Russia and China, and that basically Russia and China will have no problem with Ansarullah. And Ansarullah, because the Russian and Chinese ships are not participating in this genocide, they let the free flow of Russian and Chinese in any ship that's not participating in this genocide. They act like Ansarullah is a threat to all global trade. No, they're very specific in who that they are targeting. Anybody else who's engaging in ethical business, free to go. So the pressure of this, I think this increasing political relations will allow Iran the diplomatic strength to basically push Qatar and Egypt and these other countries in a certain direction. Now, these countries will always be corrupt. They were born out of Sykes-Picot. They were born out of British colonialism and Zionism. But in their lust for power and their lust to want to stay in power and to be relevant in the region, they're going to have to move a little bit and play a little bit of ball with Iran in order to survive politically in the future. So the hope is in the increasing diplomatic strength of Iran, coinciding with the increasing weakness of the United States.
And we don't have much time left, so Mr. Funes, let's focus more on the situation in Gaza right now. The north of Gaza is practically cut off, so even if there is humanitarian aid in Gaza, it will not reach the northern parts of Gaza. Famine is looming there for the people who are still there, stuck in that region. And also, the situation in Al-Shifa Hospital is really terrible. It's something that is completely appalling. So but what do you think will take the international community to do something to isolate Israel to the point where it will have, out of at least fear of isolation on the international scale, to back off?
I think what will work the best in terms of isolating Israel and bringing international attention and solidarity with northern Gaza will be breaking the spell and the idea that Israel is somehow a victim. This is one of the main ways that Zionism functions. It portrays Israel and the Zionist settlers as victims who are defending themselves, who are just trying to survive, who are trying to build a democracy and a stable economy in the region. And these crazy people just woke up one day and attacked them for no reason. And they perpetrate the spell in mainstream media. They perpetrate the spell in academia. We see all over in the Western academic institutions people getting fired for being in any way remotely pro-Palestine. And the dominance of Zionism over the major institutions of influence, of media, of real estate, of banking, of all of these key institutions, the commanding heights of the economy, this is crucial to their power. So as long as they control that, they're going to distract people, they're going to misinform people, and they're going to, most importantly, make people afraid to call out Zionism, because if you in any way call it out, then you're somehow anti-Semitic. So crucial to that, just as Brother Ali mentioned earlier, is destabilizing the Israeli economy once they are no longer able to maintain their grip over those key institutions and commanding heights. Once we see the emergence of Iran, Russia, China, and the BRICS global economy as the alternative that is not dependent on Zionist usury, then we can begin to see the destabilization of the Israeli economy, And then these institutions will have more freedom to criticize, to actually bring and promote aid for Gaza and to change the reality on the ground. But I think right now, one of the main issues is that the Zionist media is making it seem that if you're bringing aid to Gaza, you're promoting terrorism. And thus they're going to accuse anybody of doing that as supporting terrorism abroad. So once we are able to weaken the Israel lobby from within, weaken their economy, and actually create an alternative, then it's going to be a lot helpful. I know it sounds very long-term and idealistic, but that's just unfortunately one of the realities that we have to face with today. But first and foremost, I think the actions of Ansar Allah, of the Axis of Resistance, in cutting world trade and blocking that trade and calling for immediate tension, I think that's the best that we can do. Direct action leads to direct change. And unfortunately, that's what's going to have to take for Israel to understand. They only understand strength, and you have to respond to strength with strength.
You're absolutely right, Mr. Funes. Whatever happens at this point in time in history, we do know that right now the armed resistance of the resistance front actually is now very justified by the entire international community. I would have loved to continue this discussion with Mr. Ali Salam, editor-in-chief of Basira Press, joining us live from Tehran, and Ramiro Funes, activist and commentator from Los Angeles. But that's all the time that we have, gentlemen. Thank you very much for joining us on this edition of Spotlight.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, take advantage of the Nights of Qadr, and they are a part of our Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It is an honor to be here at your service, dear listeners. We are humbly talking about the Nights of Qadr and how we need to take full advantage of these nights and really, you know, make them a part of our Islamic lifestyle. So, as many of you know, in the holy month of Ramadan, there are certain nights which are known as the Nights of Qadr, or the Nights of Destiny, or the Nights of Power, depending upon the translation that you look at. And so, you know, these Nights of Qadr, primarily what you find in the traditions, you find three specific nights, which is the night of the 19th, the 21st, and the 23rd. Of these three nights, more emphasis has been given to the 21st and the 23rd. And of course, of these two nights, it seems like more emphasis has been given to the 23rd night of the holy month of Ramadan. But of course, in a very famous tradition from Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam, the sixth divinely appointed Imam, he says very beautifully, when somebody asks him which one of these two nights, the 21st or the 23rd, is the night of Qadr, His Eminence replied that what stops you from doing your best and completing your worship in both of these nights, meaning he doesn't necessarily lean towards either one, but he says, why don't you do all of the things that should be done in the Nights of Qadr and consider both of them? And so, you know, we would even go a little bit further and say, why don't we consider all three Nights of Qadr to be the Nights of Qadr and take the opportunity to be able to benefit and take advantage of these beautiful nights that we have coming up in the holy month of Ramadan.
رمضان المستبين جاء بالنور المبين رمضان 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 القانتين.
Welcome back. This is A2Z on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about the Nights of Qadr, and we are also talking about the holy month of Ramadan and perhaps how to implement these things in our Islamic lifestyle if we have time, inshallah. So we're talking about the Nights of Qadr. Of course, in the previous segment, we talked about how, you know, it's either the 19th or the 21st or the 23rd of the holy month of Ramadan. When it comes to our brothers and sisters in the Ahlul Sunnah, they actually go the odd nights all the way towards the end of the holy month of Ramadan. So they also include the 25th, the 27th, and the 29th of the holy month of Ramadan to be a part of the Nights of Qadr. Now, some of the things that we should definitely do in the Nights of Qadr, of course, is the recommended things, the du'as, the prayers, you know, recitation of the Holy Quran. But I want to add two things that perhaps many of us don't do. One is to spend time with our families and have a wholesome, you know, Islamic experience and conversation with our spouses or our parents or our siblings or our children. This is definitely something that must be done. I don't want to say must, but, you know, it really needs to be done in the Nights of Qadr, is to spend time with our family. Another thing is try to stay away from vain talk and vain things. Don't waste the precious time that you have in the Nights of Qadr. The third thing, definitely, you know, sometimes because, you know, we're so busy doing the ritual things that we forget to establish a connection and speak with the Almighty Allah. So speaking with Allah on the Nights of Qadr is incredibly important, especially as a part of the holy month of Ramadan, and of course something that we can continue throughout the rest of our lives as a part of our Islamic lifestyle. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of A2Z. Don't forget to visit our website at parsetoday.ir/EN Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
You lift me up high, you spread my wings and fly me to the sky. So alive, it's like my soul thrives in your light. But how I wish you'd be here with me all year around. Ramadan.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/EN. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
In the holy month of Ramadan, and as part of its commitment to Al-Quds International Day, the Islamic Republic of Iran, via its embassy in Damascus, has distributed several tons of humanitarian aid among Palestinian refugees and resistance factions in Syria. The convoy included essential food kits as a gift from the Iranian nation.
The Islamic Republic of Iran and the Axis of Resistance stand by the oppressed Palestinian people in the face of the Western and American support for the Israeli entity, which has not ceased its crimes against the Palestinian people in Gaza. Today's gathering comes within the framework of supporting the resilient and patient Palestinian people.
This gift is part of a series of annual donations offered by the Islamic Republic of Iran to Palestinian refugees during the month of Ramadan in several Syrian cities. According to Palestinian officials, this large amount of aid delivered by Iran is a message of solidarity with and commitment to the Palestinian cause.
This is a significant step within the framework of Iran's support for the resistance of the Palestinian people. This support has been reflected in all forms and means since the victory of the Islamic Revolution under the leadership of Imam Khomeini, may God rest his soul, and whose legacy continued with the leader Imam Ali Khamenei. Therefore, we as Palestinian people and resistance factions appreciate this gift and everything that the Islamic Republic is providing.
The Palestinian factions expressed their gratitude to the Islamic Republic of Iran for this gift that is presented every year to the Palestinian people.
This aid provided by the Islamic Republic of Iran during the month of Ramadan to the Palestinian people is considered as proof of Iran's great role and the interdependence between the Iranian and Palestinian people. These activities confirm the loyalty of the Palestinian people to the Axis of Resistance, in addition to the fundamental and strategic role of Syria and Iran in the Axis of Resistance.
With this humanitarian aid, Iran demonstrates that true support lies in actions rather than words, and it reflects the enduring place of the Palestinian cause in every Iranian's heart.
This gift is not only a gesture of love from the Iranian leadership and people. More importantly, it underscores their unwavering commitment to help their Palestinian brethren wherever they are. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
Pensioners rallied in hundreds of towns and cities in France against President Emmanuel Macron's determination for even more austerity cuts amid the inflation crisis. When campaigning in 2017, Macron promised he wouldn't cut pensions and that their purchasing power relative to inflation would be preserved. 7 years later, inflation has progressed 17%, while pensions have been increased just 8%. Along with his widely protested pension rollback and age hike by decree in 2023, the gap between inflation increases and pension increases may explain why perhaps no sector of society has turned against Macron more than retirees.
Think about it. How is an elderly pensioner who is largely stuck at home and unable to work is supposed to make up this gap? Now add in the increases we all see in food, heating, and electricity prices, and you can see why pensioners are so upset with Macron.
Oh, on n'est pas malheureux.
I'm active in senior citizen politics, and several years back, many pensioners would not be interested when we would distribute information leaflets to them. They'd say things like, oh, we're not unhappy, or others are poorer than us. But I can report that in recent months, no pensioner is saying that or refusing our help. That's how bad it's gotten in France, and especially in the quality of our healthcare.
Paris has warned there will soon be a second round of austerity cuts to the already austerity 2024 budget.
There are so many retirees who live on less than 900 euros per month, and everyone should be able to comprehend how difficult that is. Many of us have also diseases like cancer and diabetes, and I can promise you that none of us asked for them. We deserve dignity, and not to be treated like we are some sort of lower class citizen just because we have finished our working career.
An alternative to public service cuts would be increased taxes on the rich or corporate shareholders. But the Macron administration said it doesn't want to go digging into the pockets of the French. As the average household is still reeling from COVID and the disastrous backfiring of Europe's sanctions on Russia, a report from Oxfam found that France's billionaire families have gained 230 billion euros since 2020. That's enough to give a check of 3,400 euros to every single French person. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Hey,
To mark the National Day of Resilience and the 9th anniversary of the Saudi-led war on Yemen, Yemenis have organized multiple events across the country. This year, they are also expressing their support for the people of Palestine as Israel carries out a genocide in the Gaza Strip. Several high-ranking officials participated in these events.
Today, we celebrate the steadfastness and standing up against an aggression that has continued for years. We are defending ourselves and resisting politically, economically, and militarily in the face of the barbaric aggression in which the whole world has allied with, and a siege that is still in place. Although 9 years have passed, the aggression is still ongoing and the siege has not stopped. Therefore, we will continue to stand together until the war stops completely.
Officials state that the Saudi-led war continues despite failing to achieve its stated objectives. They argue that the U.S. does not want the war to end, aiming to subdue the Yemenis, especially after Yemen began its naval operations in support of Palestine.
There are lots of agendas that were not achieved by the war in Yemen, and therefore America wants to at least reach the rest of its goals regarding Yemen. But the truth is that a Yemeni victory has been achieved, and we have imposed our presence. We united in political, military, and social level, so Yemen succeeded in absorbing the strategic transformations, imposing itself in the Red and Arabian Seas, and supporting the Palestinian cause. America has no choice but to accept this reality.
In the meantime, the spokesman for the Yemeni army reported 6 military operations over the past 3 days. These operations included targeting 3 American and British vessels with missiles and drones in the Gulf of Aden and the Red Sea, while another vessel heading to Israeli-occupied ports was also hit. The Yemeni army also launched an attack on 2 U.S. destroyers. Yemeni forces also successfully struck the occupied territories with ballistic missiles.
After 9 years of U.S.-backed war and siege, observers believe that Yemen today is stronger than ever, being the only country to have supported Palestine through military action. They argue that Yemenis are confident they are on the right path as long as Washington continues to bombard and terrorize them. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
For more than 170 days, the Israeli operations in the besieged Gaza Strip have resulted in the deaths of more than 32,000 individuals. The latest incident involves an attack on Al-Shifa Hospital, where witnesses have reported extensive atrocities. In reaction, Iranians assembled in front of the Turkish embassy on Monday to voice their indignation.
People gathered here to condemn Israeli genocide in Gaza, urging Muslim states, including Turkey, to halt exporting energy to the regime.
Participants lament that the international community has thus far remained silent regarding Israel.
We as women have come here with our children because we witnessed the Israeli action against Palestinian women and children. Sadly, the international community has remained silent.
Regrettably, Turkey as a Muslim nation exports significant raw materials, including metal, to Israel. If Turkey were to cut off this supply and prevent exports to Israel through the Ceyhan port, it would exert considerable pressure on Israel. We also call on other Muslim countries like Azerbaijan, which supplies 40% of Israel's oil, to cease their support.
This plea follows Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, leader of the Islamic Revolution, urging Muslim nations to cut political and economic ties with Israel. Protesters also cited Imam Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Republic, who highlighted the role of Muslims in opposing Israel by saying, "If the Muslims of the world united and each poured a bucket of water, Israel would be washed away." Farzana Shuryun, Tehran.
In the Great Mosque of the Old City of Sana'a, the Yemeni Scholars Association convened a meeting calling for the nation's scholars to fulfill their role in the Al-Aqsa Fluid Battle and the ensuing victory. The event saw a significant turnout of Yemeni scholars.
Our message to the scholars who have shirked their responsibility to support Gaza is to fear God, for that will expose them to God's punishment in this world and the hereafter. Silence regarding what our brothers endure in Gaza amounts to participating in the Zionist enemy's crimes against children and women. The people will also justify their silence with the silence of their scholars and rulers. Therefore, their sin is greater than that of the rest of the people.
The participants criticized the inaction of Muslim scholars regarding the atrocities in Gaza, labeling it the genocidal war by Israel. They emphasized the scholars' profound responsibility, asserting their religious duty to support their Palestinian brothers. They argued that the current situation in Palestine is the consequence of decades of silence.
The responsibility of the scholars is great, as they are the ones who can move the streets and the people, and they can compel the rulers to act with the fatwa or word from them in support of Gaza.
Since the onset of the war on Gaza, Yemeni scholars have actively participated in weekly demonstrations supporting Palestine and have encouraged public demonstrations in solidarity. Furthermore, the Scholars Association has declared its support for the Yemeni military's naval operations targeting Israeli maritime activities and its allies.
Yemeni scholars assert that the normalization deals between Arab countries and Israel have emboldened the regime to continue its oppressive campaign against Palestinians. They urge all Muslim scholars to advocate for Palestine, regardless of their government's possessions. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Iraqi Prime Minister Mohammed Shah al-Sudani will meet with U.S. President Joe Biden in Washington on April 15 for talks on the U.S. military presence in the Arab country. Also, a range of other issues, including the fight against Daesh and the ongoing Iraqi financial reforms, will be discussed.
The demands of Iraqi nation and political blocs will be taken to Washington by the Prime Minister. We all know there is a large consensus in the country to end the foreign forces' presence. The Prime Minister will also discuss the economic situation and challenges, most importantly, the U.S. dollar exchange rates, which have been affecting the market since the imposition of sanctions by U.S. Treasury on Iraqi banks.
In January, Baghdad and Washington began formal talks about ending the coalition mission, purportedly formed to help the Iraqi forces to fight Daesh terrorist group. After the defeat of Daesh in 2017 by Iraqi anti-terror forces, the U.S. still stationed some 2,500 troops in Iraq and 900 in neighboring Syria as a part of the coalition mission.
It's time for the government to end the coalition mission. It's the demand of the Iraqi people. We all agree that these forces have gone too far, violating our sovereignty, so today we witness the calls by the Iraqi nation that the time has come for these forces to leave.
Following the parliamentary decision in 2020, Iraqi authorities have agreed for drawing up a timeline to end the presence of foreign forces, which proved by action to be a threat to the country's stability. Iraqi nation agrees that foreign forces' presence is no longer necessary, and the Prime Minister will carry their demands to Washington. Muslim Salem, Baghdad.
Salman Qasimi, an Islamic school teacher, says it's an unprecedented move in India to ban madrasas instantly, calling it a blow to marginalized Muslim families across India's most populous state of Uttar Pradesh. He says lives of thousands of families are directly dependent on such institutions, while the government of Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi accuses them of receiving illegal funding. Scholars argue such institutions are building blocks of Islamic teachings across the country, which regular schools can't do.
This judgment is unfortunate. We respect the court decision, but we oppose it. Our constitution allows us to have such schools to teach Islamic values to future generations. If this is against secularism, why it was made in the first place? Every citizen can read, write, promote or propagate their religion. That's what our constitution says. Madrasa's instant closure is a blow to livelihood of thousands of families.
In January, the government of Uttar Pradesh state halted a funding program for madrasas, leaving more than 20,000 teachers unemployed. Scholars say Friday's verdict applies to all Islamic schools in the state that are privately and government funded. In recent months, India's northeastern state of Assam converted hundreds of madrasas into conventional schools.
All the laws and all the things which are BJP is enacting or BJP is targeting the Muslim community, definitely they think that the if they want to rule the country, so they can rule the country when they can demonize Muslim community, they can suppress Muslim community, they can make them wetless at the time of election. So all these efforts are taking place because of the RSS background, RSS agenda of the present ruling party.
In recent months, Modi's government turned down new proposals from the states and halted payments to schemes that would finance Muslim schools. Critics say this amounts to snatching the livelihood of thousands of families instantly, while they have no other means of earning.
India will hold general elections in a few weeks' time, and the BJP's victory is imminent, according to observers. Activists and rights groups have accused the governing party of promoting anti-Islamic rhetoric in a deliberate attempt to appease the majority voters by polarizing the voters, therefore using divide-and-rule policy to win the elections.
Rights groups have accused the BJP government of persecuting and intimidating Muslims through all possible means. The accusation BJP rejects, saying India is a vibrant democracy enshrined in equality for all. Critics accuse the ruling party of systematic repression against the largest minority group, including hate crimes, mob lynching and cow vigilantism amid rising Islamophobia. Observers say such issues pave the way for Prime Minister Modi to remain in office for a third consecutive term. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Pakistan has joined the global celebrations of a very special Nowruz that has coincided with the holy month of Ramadan. Nowruz, which translates to New Day, is celebrated by millions of peoples worldwide as the Persian New Year, symbolizing rebirth, renewal, and arrival of spring.
To all my fellow Pakistanis celebrating Nowruz, I say let's cherish our cultural diversity and come together in solidarity. May this new year bring us prosperity, peace, and happiness.
Despite its Persian origins, Nowruz in Pakistan is celebrated with a distinctive local flavor, incorporating regional traditions and customs. Pakistanis have their own customs to welcome Nowruz. Besides preparing special meals and decorating the dining area with special dried and fresh fruits, the ancient occasion also creates an opportunity for individuals to mend broken ties, forgive others, let go of the past, and build stronger relationships in the coming new year.
For me, Nowruz is a time of reflection and renewal. It's a reminder to leave behind the past year's troubles and embrace the opportunities that lie ahead. It's a celebration of life, growth, and the beauty of nature.
We clean our house, we visit our friends, we celebrate this day, we enjoy a lot of festive foods, and you know, this day brings a lot of joy and happiness in our lives. So, happy Nowruz to all of you.
Pakistan's President Asif Ali Zardari and Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif have extended their heartfelt greetings to all those who are celebrating Nowruz in Pakistan and around the world. Both leaders also called for embracing the spirit of Nowruz and promoting the message of peace, compassion, unity, and kindness.
Nowruz signifies regeneration at the start of a new cycle. It transcends simple festivity, standing as a cultural landmark that enhances the diversity of human society. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
After weeks of silence, Kitab Hezbollah Resistance Group, one of the biggest units within Iraq's popular mobilization units, reminds the government, as well as officials in the committee tasked with overseeing the withdrawal of U.S. military, that they should not grant immunity to the occupying forces, or else gates of hell will open.
These foreign forces have been violating our sovereignty for years now. In January 2020, Donald Trump ordered the assassination of our anti-terror commanders, Lieutenant General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in Baghdad airport. And lately, they are violating it by assassination of Iraqi resistance commanders.
Kitab Hezbollah also warned that any removal of leaders of popular mobilization units must be decided by the PMU internally. It says acting otherwise would be a significant mistake.
Our government has made it clear on multiple occasions that the need for U.S. military forces have ended. Our security forces are capable of running the country's security system and face any threat. Washington is clearly trying to rally around the negotiations, and it is a clear attempt to delay their withdrawal from the country.
In January, the Iraqi resistance decided to halt the attacks on U.S. bases in Iraq and Syria. The attacks were started on October 19 in solidarity with Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Observers say that the suspension was to allow a climate of serenity for talks between Baghdad and Washington over the U.S. military presence. But as some have rightly noted, Washington has no intention to change its behavior in Iraq.
It is obvious that Washington is trying to gain more time to keep its military presence in Iraq. Our government needs to push forward and speed up the pace of negotiations to end the presence of these foreign forces and save our country's political, economic, and social stability.
On paper, the U.S. military forces are present in the country for advisory purposes, as well as training the Iraqi forces to fight Daesh terrorist group. However, in practice, the U.S. forces have shown a different objective by violating Iraqi sovereignty, attacking PMU positions, and killing top Iraqi commanders. Since the start of their operations in October, the resistance in Iraq has been pushing the government to end the U.S. military presence in the country. Also, they have time and again reiterated their solidarity with Palestinians. Muslim Salim, Baghdad.
This is Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of Arab English Radio. Welcome back to a new episode of Back to Reality. Well, this is me, Asma. Once more, I have the pleasure to be at your service. And then here with me, I have two very dear guests. Assalamu alaikum, Brother Mustafa, and assalamu alaikum, Sister Nahid.
Wa alaikum assalam.
So, as the ritual of this program goes, I would love you both to introduce yourself pretty briefly. Let's start with Sister Nahid.
Assalamu alaikum to you and your dear listeners. My name is Nahid, and I'm so honored to be with you and your listeners today.
Thank you very much for being here, and you, Brother Mustafa.
My name is Mustafa, and I'm studying here in the Hauza. I'm studying psychology here, and I'm originally from Pakistan, but I've lived in different countries.
So, thank you very much, both of you, for coming here and for joining us in today's episode. Well, there is a quote by Imam Ali alayhi salam. He actually makes an analogy between the problems of this world and the nightmares. He says that in a world in which the problems and the catastrophes that you're going to go through and the obstacles that you're going to face are just as horrible as the nightmares, but again, they're not going to be long-lasting like the nightmares. How tolerant you are, just as a way of examining yourself, how tolerant you are in a world of problems, but considering this very fact, the problems of this world are not long-lasting. They are nightmarish, but eventually the morning would come, like what we have in the Holy Book of Quran, إِنَّمَا الْعُسْرَ يُسْرَ. Eventually the problems are going to go away, but the point which is important is how tolerant you're going to be.
When we're going through difficulties and those obstacles, it feels like they're going to last forever.
Yeah.
Right? But then if we just examine our life that we had, they eventually do go away, right?
Yeah.
Eventually, we do go over them. But that's the whole test, right? That's the entire test of being in this world, is like how well you can understand the realities of this world, and how are you going to maintain yourself through those difficulties?
Yeah.
If we didn't have those difficulties, it wouldn't really be a test then, and then things would be kind of meaningless, right?
Mm-hmm. But what kind of a person you are in facing those problems?
Now,
this is
personally?
A personal question, yes.
I'm not a very good person, and I would say I definitely need to be much stronger in facing those kind of problems. The interesting thing is when I'm going through those difficulties, I know intellectually that this thing, this true, it's going to go away, that this time will pass.
Yeah, I know all these things, but I cannot act accordingly.
But the emotional state that that I'm going through it's what's causing me grief or is causing
exactly.
me problems.
Yeah.
I would say over time, of course, I've gotten better. With age, I've gotten better with more difficult situations in life. And of course, with knowledge, I think the knowledge part has really helped me.
You know, years ago, I wasn't this much tolerant of life difficulties, but from one point in my life, I started just reading more, and I have chosen one strategy for the difficulties.
I
jot down all the things that I'm going through, and like when the next problem occurs to me, when I look at those previous notes, I remember that I was in a very bad situation. I had a life dilemma, but yeah, I did it, and now it's gone. And this will really be like a relief for me in that situation. Yeah.
For me, if I do that and if I just jot them down and make a list out of them, it would be a succession of whatever misery I've been through. So this is going to make the situation even worse.
Really? No. Yeah. When I look at the situation, I realize that it's over, that I could accomplish that hard situation. It gives me the power. Like, you
so
did it
you
that time. You can do it this time as well.
You write your experiences.
Yeah.
And you say,
I write even the small details of my feeling. Like, I'm feeling really sad now. Mm-hmm. I don't know what to do. And these stuff. And the next time when I read them, they kind of motivate me. Like, you were in that situation and you handled it. Mm-hmm. So this can happen again here too. But it's still educating ourselves and our brains necessarily can really help. Like, reading books. Since I started reading some psychological books, they really helped me.
Well, according to my personal interpretation, I would say that education is good. Age is going to change everything. Yeah. But then again, when you're going to face a problem, it's as if you're a child.
Yeah.
You have never had any experience in this world.
Yeah.
Like, again, it's pretty much easier said than done. Like, I know this shall to pass. But then this situation, the amount of burden it's going to put on my shoulder, I mean, emotional burden, is going to be much enough to make me feel like it's not going to end.
Well,
and I think we have to go through a lot of practices to change our perspective, the way we're going to deal with things. And time, of course, is going to be one of those things that would change you and the way you are going to look at things. So this was just the introduction. We go for a break and then we'll come back to see what's more. So for sure, when God make us face the difficulties, and actually let me just rephrase it, it's not God. Sometimes it's a reflection of our decisions and the reflection of whatever we have done in this world. Whenever there's a problem, for sure, God knows that I have the capacity to face this because He has said that He is not going to ask us more than our capacities and potentials. So what kind of elements you think we must have as human beings to be considered as a tolerate person, like a person who's going to tolerate too much of difficulties?
I guess maturity plays the biggest role here. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, once I was talking to a therapist about the first moments or the first minute that you realize you're facing a really hard situation. And his recommendation was that the first moment or the first second that you're just acting like a child, you're being feeling too many emotions at the same time. You want to cry, shout, escape, leave the situation.
Yeah.
In that moment, he recommended that, okay, that's fine. Even that's fine to be a child. By maturity, I mean that we should recognize that even it's okay to be a child sometimes and give that situation a cry, a hard cry, and just free ourselves from those emotions. This can be also one aspect of maturity. And his recommendation really helped me. Like, you can free yourself from your emotions. That's okay to even cry. That's okay to feel like you can't do anything. But after you are just free of those emotions, those annoying emotions at that time, you can react better in a more logical way.
We shouldn't be afraid of seeking help from others. You know, because not everyone's a child, right? Not everyone's going to behave in the same manner. So if we find people that are stronger than us, you know, who've maybe who have stronger personalities, then we should seek help from them. And those people can then help us in return. And I've faced that situation many times in life where I've maybe asked my father for help, one of my teachers for help, you know, one of my friends for help.
Yeah.
And that's helped sort of like alleviate